Hey, this is Pastor Ricky Ortiz at MetaChurch, and I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning into our podcast and supporting our ministry. If you'd like to learn more about MetaChurch, you can visit us online at meta.church, and we're praying this message inspires you and encourages you to pursue your relationship with Jesus. I'm going to begin where I ended last week, And so if you remember it or don't remember it, we're going to kind of catch you up on it. But if you weren't here and you haven't listened to it, I would definitely encourage you to go back, watch the video on YouTube or Facebook or listen to the podcast. It is by far, in my opinion, the best sermon I've ever preached in less than 30 minutes. Now, part of the catch is I don't preach a lot of sermons under 30 minutes, so I have a small selection. But in my opinion, it was my favorite and my best sermon that I've preached in less than 30 minutes. And one of the things that we talked about in this message last week is that the new that Jesus established, we're in this series called New, the new that Jesus established, the new that Jesus implemented through his death, his burial, and his resurrection wasn't just something about kind of a contract talk. It wasn't just something about how we get to God. It was about us. It was something relevant and pertinent to us that in Jesus, or through Jesus, we ourselves, you and I, can experience new. That you and I can step into something new. That in fact, our old lives, as Paul would write about, our old lives are completely done and put away with, and our new lives can be lived in. We just have to step forward into it. We just have to take the time or take the realization that we don't have to be trapped by the old way of life. And we talked about this transformation that can take place in our lives. Specifically, we looked at the people or some of the people who were close to Jesus and how their lives were different after the resurrection, how they experienced transformation. You know, we talked about Thomas, who was doubtful and skeptical and not really sure about certain things. But then after the resurrection, he became faithful. He became steadfast. He became the type of person that experienced something so significant that the reason we know about him is because of the change. It's because of what happened after Jesus. We talked about Mark, who was a gospel writer, but Mark wasn't good enough or cool enough or selected to be a part of Jesus' inner 12. He was just kind of someone on the peripheral who was around, but not necessarily in. And how sometimes we can feel like maybe we're not good enough, maybe we're not the ones that fit in, maybe we're not the ones that are selected or that stand out. Yet Mark started one of the most influential gatherings or groups of Christians in the entire history of the world. And because of what Mark did in Alexandria, Egypt, the gospel spread throughout the continent of Africa. That someone who maybe felt left out or someone who maybe felt kind of disregarded was able to make a step and become a transformed person who became influential and important. And of course, we talked about Peter, who is kind of like me in the sense that you're outspoken and you put your foot in your mouth a lot and you do things that don't really make sense and you're impulsive. And I do that a lot. And I'm very impulsive. I ordered cookies this week late at night thanks to insomnia. And then I went and bought cookie dough last night because I wanted lemonade. And so I wanted juice. And so I was like, I'm going to go to the store and get juice. I was like, you know, I need cookies too. And so I'm just impulsive. I don't, like a lot of this stuff just doesn't make sense. And Peter was that guy. Peter was the guy that was impulsive, but he was also cowardly. He was also fearful. Yet after the resurrection, he became bold. He became strategic. He became, you know, the type of person that we would look to today and say, wow, he was so great. He was so incredible. But he wasn't always that way. And the point that I left it at, or the question that I left to you, is who do you want to become? Not just, like, who are you, but who do you want to become? Because if that's what Jesus did for them, what is it that Jesus wants to do for you? Who is it that Jesus wants to shape you to become? Because there's new to be had, and there's new to take hold of. We just have to step into it. And I shared that this is important, but at the same time, I think one of the things that if you really kind of begin following that path, if you start kind of understanding that logic and that understanding that God wants to do something new in you, then you also have to ask the question, why? Like, or what is it for? What's the reason or what's the purpose? Because on paper, it makes sense to me that if God were to change us, if God were to create a new path, if God were to create a new way to connect with him, if God were to create like new terms of a relationship, and he were going to transform me, that it would make sense that I would be kind of, in a sense, like zapped or zoomed right into his presence. That in a way, it's like if God wanted me to be new, if God wanted me to experience something new, it was because he wanted me to be connected to him in the physical or in the spiritual and in a kind of a person-to-person way, so that we could benefit or that he could benefit or that we could share or partake in this new. And yet, obviously, that's not the case, right? If you follow Jesus or if you commit to following God and you give your life to that, it's not like all of a sudden, boom, things are different and you're moved into a different planet. You're moved into a different universe. You're moved into a different, there's just, it just doesn't happen. I mean, obviously, we're all here, right? And so there's elements that connect with God, and there's elements that, you know, we experience God, but you also have to ask the question, like, why is it that something new is offered, something new is experienced, yet I'm still in the same or in the old place? Like, what's the reason for that? Because why would God go all out of his way to create all new everything only for us to live and operate and experience the same old, same thing? It doesn't make sense. And yet, with that, I think that question, if you really kind of try to press into that, what you would find is that question or that feeling is not unique to us or exclusive to us. In fact, I would say that this is the same feeling or the same question that the disciples, Jesus' 12 followers, were experiencing or were wrestling with on the night before Jesus was crucified, when they gathered together to share a meal. If you remember the story or if you remember the situation, they gathered to celebrate the Passover meal. Big celebration, huge deal, you know, great time to get together, eat lots of food, you know, recognize what God has done for you. And so they're having this great meal and they're having this great time. But you got to think about what ends up happening, okay? You have a good Passover meal. You're connected with your buddies. You're hanging out. You're drinking some wine. You're eating some food. It's everything's going exactly as planned. But then things start to get a little bit weird. Because, you know, people, as they're talking, eating, Jesus decides he's going to get up, and he's going to start washing people's feet, which, I don't care what the historical context is, it's weird. Like, if you were to come to my house, and we were to have dinner together, and you say, you know what, I got something to do, and you were to get up, and you were to start unlacing my shoes, like, you would get kicked. You would just get kicked right in the face, and there'd be no questions asked, and it would be justified, because it's weird that you're trying to touch my feet. But Jesus just starts touching people's feet, he starts washing their feet, and you know, they're cool with it. There's a historical side of it. Yeah, I get it. But that's not just the weird part. Like, that might be kind of untimely because technically that should have been done when they entered the home, not once they sat down to eat. So whatever. Okay, that's a little bit off. But where it gets weird is when Jesus starts talking about the fact that one of these people are going to betray him. That's where things get a little bit awkward. You're at dinner with your family. You're at dinner with your friends. And everyone's having a great time. Yeah, remember that one time we went and hung out over here? Remember that one time? Hey, guys, real quick. One of you is going to stab me right in the back tonight. Wait, what? One of you. Here. Well, who is it? Don't worry about it. Well, who's going to stab you in the back, Jesus? Who's going to betray you? Is it me? They all get insecure. Like, is it me? Is it me? Surely it can't be me. And then Jesus, like, he does a kind of like this subtle, maybe passive aggressive thing where he doesn't really say who's going to do it. He's just, it's the one who I give the one who I give this cup to. The one who I pass this plate to. And so it's like, okay, well, who's he passing the plate to? And I don't know if he did it immediately or if he waited a period of time, but at some point he identified that the guy Judas was going to be his betrayer. And then it doesn't just end there. Again, this is kind of going from one level of weirdness to another level of weirdness to another level, a third level of awkwardness, because Jesus says, as if that's not enough, one of you is going to betray me. But then he goes on and he starts to explain something that the disciples can't seem to figure out. And that's where we're going to pick up in John's gospel, John chapter 13. John kind of captures this intimate setting, and he writes about it in this way. So Judas has been identified as the one who's going to betray Jesus, and verse 31 says this: as soon as Judas left the room, Jesus said, "The time has come for the Son of Man to enter into his glory, and God will be glorified because of him. And since God receives glory because of the Son, he will soon give glory to the Son." So he's speaking in Dr. Seuss. Verse 33, "Dear children, I will be with you only a little longer, and as I told the Jewish leaders," here's where it gets weird, "you will search for me, but you can't come where I'm going." Verse 34, "So now I'm giving you a new commandment, love each other just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you're my disciples." So pause. Jesus says, you can't go where I'm going. And then he just kind of like tries to change the subject. Hey, as I've loved you, love other people. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you're my disciples. But the disciples aren't having it. They come back to it. Simon Peter, the one who kind of speaks out, he says this, "Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus replied, "You can't go with me now, but you will follow me later." Verse 37, "But why can't I come now, Lord?" He asked, "I'm ready to die for you." So here's the awkwardness. Here's someone that you've given your life to. You got to put this in context. Remember, because these guys had given everything to follow Jesus. They left businesses. They left family members. They left friends. They left geographic regions and homes to stay with this guy. Not just for a week, not for a three-day men's camp. This was like a lifetime commitment. For 3 years, they'd been journeying and traveling with this guy. And they've gone everywhere with Jesus. Wherever Jesus went, they went. Whatever Jesus was about to do, they were a part of partaking in, of observing, of witnessing, of experiencing. And so when Jesus at this dinner, a family dinner, a celebratory time, is saying to them, hey, I'm about to leave, but you can't go where I'm going, it's kind of awkward. What do you mean I can't go where you're going? Why not? Who said I can't go where you're going? What do you mean you're leaving us? Why are you leaving us? We've given up everything to follow you. Where are we going to go? We don't have anywhere to go back to. You left us. We left everything for you, but now you're going to leave us? Well, how foolish does that make you feel? How weird will that be? How uncomfortable? How discouraging it must have felt in that situation to hear this person, not that you followed, but that you love, say to you, I'm leaving and you can't come with me. I'm going somewhere, but you won't be able to go with me. How disheartening to think, well, where am I going to go? I've turned everything over to you. It's all yours. And maybe, just a side note, maybe this is how you felt in your life. Maybe you felt like you've given God everything. You've entrusted God with your life. You've said, God, it's all yours. I'll give you whatever you want. I'll follow you wherever you take me. God, I'll do whatever you need me to do. And then only to discover, or only to feel like later on in your life, that God is no longer with you. That God has somehow left you. That God has forgotten about you, or that God has forsaken you, or that he's moved on from you. He said, okay, God, I'm going to give my life to you. It's going to be the best thing ever. This is the best decision I can make. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to surrender to you. I'm going to trust you. And yet you did all those things and nothing has worked out the way you planned or the way you hoped or the way you dreamed or the way you expected when you thought God was going to be your ride or die. When you thought I'll go wherever he goes and things are going to be great, yet I don't have the family that I envisioned. I don't have the dream scenario or the job that I expected or the career path that I wanted. When I look at my bank account, there's a lot of zeros, and it's not because there's a lot of commas in front of those zeros. There's just a lot of emptiness, and there's nothing there that substantiates everything I've sacrificed or that justifies everything I've given up and entrusted to God. Maybe you have kids, or maybe you feel like that family member that you've prayed or kind of turned over to God, and you thought by now that they would be different. You thought by now their life would be different. You thought they would be surrendered, or you thought they would be kind of stepping forward. You did everything right. You planned it out. You scripted it. You said, this is the agenda. This is the way it's going to work. And when I take these steps, this person is going to be committed to Jesus, and their life is going to be better for it, because that's what happens when you give your life to Jesus. You've done all those things, and nothing is the way it's supposed to be. Not only is it not the way it's supposed to be, but God feels like he's left you. God feels like he's forgotten about you. God feels like he's moved on from you, that he's abandoned you. And listen, I don't know if that's how you feel. I don't know if that's how you felt. But I can tell you this thing. God may have felt or might have left you for a moment, but it wasn't because there wasn't reason, or it wasn't because there wasn't purpose, or it might feel like God has forsaken you, but it's not because he's hiding, and it's not because he's forgotten or because he stopped loving you. God might have felt like he departed or he kind of moved on to something, but it's not because he's not working on a destiny. Instead, God had to step away from you in order for you to step into what he has for you. In fact, it's more like this. It's more like when you learn how to ride a bike for the first time and your parent is holding the back of that seat and they're moving you forward, and at some point they just have to let you go. It's not that they left you, it's that you step forward on your own, and God is doing the same thing so that you can learn how to ride the bicycle of life apart from someone holding on to you. And he's saying, hey, I'm still here, I'm still supporting you, I'm still championing you, and I'm with you. It just feels like you've left, or it feels like I've left, because you've been able to move out on your own.
That's good.
I know it's good. I know it's good. Seriously, I know it's good, because when I was writing this down on my computer sitting in this little co-work, I was like, this is so good. And the Holy Spirit said this is so you, Ricky. Yeah, you think this is for everyone else. You think this is for all the people who are going to sit and listen. You think this is for the people who are going to watch. This is for you, because I felt that way. Can I be honest with you? I felt like God has forgotten about me. I felt like the number of times that I've given God my bank account, the number of times I've given God my life, the number of times I've given God my family, the number of times I've given God my dreams and my careers, and surrendered all these things over and said, God, I'm just going to trade it all in. I'm going to give it all into you. I'm not trying to cash it in. I'm trading it in, because I'm expecting that what you have for me is more significant or better than what I envision or what I'm willing to hold on to. And so I'll give it to you, God, only to feel like on this side of things, I'm not getting anything in return. Only to feel like the prayers that we've been praying for as a family for years are not being answered or heard. only to feel like once again when God says, okay, it's time to give it all up, and it's like, all right, God, we did this before, you provided, you answered, but now it's time to do it all over again. One more time? Why? For what? What's the reason or what's the purpose? And in that moment, in that kind of space where God was speaking to me and the Holy Spirit was just kind of ministering to me this week, one of the things he was saying is, Ricky, there's purpose in this. There's reason for it. You can't see it now. This is the numerator, not the denominator. There's a bigger plan underneath what you see on the top of this. Just trust me in this because I've got something for you. And if God has something for me, he has something for you. And listen, I said this is a side note. This is kind of a sidebar commentary to the message that I want to get to in just a second. But I'm trusting that someone here needs to hear the fact that you feel like God has isolated or forgotten you or deserted you. But he has something for you. He's not forgotten you. He's not abandoned you. He's not neglected you. He's not withheld his love from you. He's working something that you can't see just yet. And there's a reason and there's a purpose for it. Just like there was, or just like there is in my life, and just like there was some 2,000 years ago when Jesus informed his disciples, I'm going to be leaving and you can't go with me. And here's what Jesus had. Here's kind of the plan or the vision. In fact, go back to verses 34 and 35 when Jesus tried to change the subject and the disciples were like, not so fast. Jesus had something for them. I'm now giving you a new commandment. Love each other just as I have loved you. You should love each other. Your love for one another will prove, notice this, to the world that you are my disciples. Here's the why, what, and the how. Here's the reason, the purpose, the significance behind Jesus leaving and the disciples staying was this. I've got to go, but I'm leaving, and you now are going to carry the torch. You now are going to show to the world who I am. You now are going to be my representatives. You now are going to be my reflections. You now are going to be the images of God in person, in the flesh, because I've got to go, but you can't go with me yet. And so I need you here to be the ones that show the world who I am. And yes, God can do it apart from us, but instead God chooses to do it through us. Jesus said a new commandment, love each other just as I love you. You see, the reason Jesus left them, the reason Jesus needed to go on apart from them was because this world that they lived in, this ancient world, was devoid of all love. You remember this, I think it was like maybe, let's say, 7th, 8th, or 9th grade history, okay? World history class, somewhere in that range. Hammurabi's Code, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. This is the world they lived in. Someone did something wrong, they paid the price with how they wronged you. They took something from you, you took something from them. If they hurt you physically, then you physically hurt them back. That was the world they lived in. That was the code. That was the law. Not only that, they lived in a time of Roman imperialism, where the Roman Empire is expanding across a whole region at all costs, at any expense, and whoever stood in their way was sure to pay the price with their lives. And so they didn't know love in this way. They didn't see love in this way. It was a world that was clearly desperate for love. It was violent. It was unforgiving. And yet Jesus stepped into that time frame. Jesus stepped into that world and revealed and showed everyone what love looked like. Love wasn't just a noun. I've said this before. Love was a verb. He made love into an action and demonstrated this is what it looks like to live out love for other people. And so now you, my followers, are entrusted to show love to the rest of this aching world, to the rest of this hurting world. And let's be honest for just a moment. We can talk about the ancient world. We can kind of rip on it and say they were so violent, they were so aggressive, they were so this, they were so that. But let's be honest, our world is in need of love just like they were. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We may not speak about wars in kind of a positive light. We may not talk about, you know, this kind of Hammurabi's Code as the way of living. We know those things are wrong and those injustices shouldn't exist. But we live in a world today that is still desperate and in need of love. Yeah. We live in a time frame. It doesn't matter how modern we are. It doesn't matter how, quote, civilized we are. Doesn't matter if we're third world, second world, or first world. Our world, all of them, need love. There are people in this room, there are people in this building, there are people in this city who are in need of love, not because love can't be found, but because they don't know where to get it. Because they don't know who to trust it from. And this new commandment, you see, this commandment that Jesus gave some 2,000 years ago, I'll give you a little secret, is the same command, it's the same issue that he has for you and I today. To love in this way. See, more than ever, I think we live in a time and in a space that's so self-centered and so self-oriented, and it's all about me at the expense of you. Doesn't matter if that's in work, it doesn't matter if that's in politics, it doesn't matter if that's in relationships. It's about me leveraging you as a resource for my benefit, for my gain, and for my advantage. And I leverage that, and I don't care if it hurts you. I don't care what consequences. Yeah, I mean, if it's going to give me some kind of political clout, if it's going to give me some sort of social clout, if it's going to make me, quote, look better in the eyes of other people, then I'll do something. But there's a hidden agenda, and the agenda is typically almost always about me. It's about what serves me. It's about what benefits me. And why is it about me? Because what I need is love, but I can't find love in all these other places, so I'll just do whatever it takes to fill the void, to pretend that something deeper, something more significant is there, but the only thing that can fill that space is love. The only thing. And yet, more than ever, as we kind of accelerate into this world of me-centric, we act or pretend as if we're more civilized or more advanced than our, you know, ancient counterparts, yet we still don't know how to love. We still don't know how to show love. Many times we don't even know how to receive love. We don't know what to do with that. And here's the thing, because it's not like it's everyone out there that's bad, and then these people in here, like we're all the good ones, because you and I, we've been the type to not show love. We've been the type to withhold love from other people, because they, quote, don't deserve it, or because they, quote, don't need it, or I don't know that they need it, so I'll withhold it anyway and assume they don't need it. And we've been the type to do that. We've been the type to get snappy with people. We've been the type to get angry with people. We've been the type to go off on someone. We've been the type to push someone through the subway. We've been the type to force our way and speak our own mind at the expense of someone else or their experiences or their perspectives or their stories. We've been that type. And the fact is, I would guess from me, all of you, that nobody here likes it when they do that. Nobody here likes that person. Yet it's become, in a sense, our kind of in our minds, a justified, necessary evil to make it through. I don't like when I'm not loving, yet I'll be unloving if it means it works to my benefit, if it means it satisfies whatever I'm looking for. And this is why Jesus spoke. This is why Jesus said, this is why you're here, because I've got something for you that has to show to everyone else. And what I want to do is kind of look at this in two parts to help us kind of action this and live this out and realize how much of a difference it can only it can make, not just in our lives, but in the world around us. And so there's two parts to this. First is this. Jesus said this, just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. When it comes to love, there's no question that Jesus was the benchmark. Jesus set the example. We wouldn't know love apart from Jesus, not to the degree that Jesus set the standard. You see, it's easy for us. Jesus didn't just say love each other. Okay, this isn't like hippie feel-good stuff. Jesus put some parameters around this love. He specifically said love each other as I have loved you. You see, it wasn't nebulous, it wasn't vague. That was specific, because you could open this book, you could open these pages and see how Jesus loves. It's defined. It's clear. You see, this took love from a vague and kind of out there concept to a tangible, tactile, real thing that we could do, that we could mimic, that we could follow and kind of adapt for our lives, because Jesus, in a world that was desperate for love, Jesus loved people with grace, with compassion, with dignity, and with truth. It was all of these things and so much more. There was grace in his love. The people who were unlovable, untouchable, unwelcomed, justifiably so or unjustified. You know, we rag a lot of times because in the scriptures you'll read about these people who were lepers, people who had this skin disease and how they were kind of outcast and removed from society. And it's easy to look at that in a kind of judgmental way, but in a limited medicinal world, that's what they had to do to protect the rest of the people. You couldn't have this contagious person just freely walking around touching anyone or anything. And so they were removed, but Jesus said, you know what? That might be justified, but it's not justified that they don't receive love. So I will love them. I'll show grace to that person. There was compassion. Those who were wounded, those who were hurting, those who were broken. Jesus demonstrated compassion in a world, again, that didn't have compassion. Compassion wasn't a metric of the law. Compassion wasn't a barometer of achievement. Compassion was non-existent. And Jesus chose to show compassion. Dignity. Those who were both physically, spiritually, or all of them, I guess, physically, spiritually, and emotionally beat down, Jesus would love that person in such a way that they were dignified and raised up. Sometimes it was physical. Sometimes it was spiritual. A lot of times it was all of the above. Then a dignifying way he could love someone, even if he didn't agree with what they were doing, even if he didn't like what they were doing, even if what they were doing was contrary to what was right, he would still offer them a dignifying love. And of course, truth, which is the beauty in this, because Jesus' love didn't shy away from truth. It's weird. It almost seems impossible, especially when you look at or when you live in a world of CNN and Fox News, but you can speak truth and show love. Now, I don't know who's speaking truth on either of those networks. It depends on what your perspective is, I suppose, but here's what I know. Neither one is choosing to show love. Yet Jesus showed that it's possible. Jesus showed that it can be done. In fact, it should be done. And this is the type of love that we're supposed to show you and I as followers of Jesus, or those of us who have committed our lives to Jesus. This is the type of love that we're supposed to show to any and everyone, no matter who they are, no matter where they've been, no matter what they believe, no matter whether we agree with them or not. This is the kind of love that we are called to show. And here's why we don't do it: because it's messy, because it's difficult, because it's hard. It would be easy for me to just love the people who I agree with. It would be easy for me to just love the people that look like me, talk like me, and act like me. But when I have to love people on the other side of these things, you know who needs grace? Someone who doesn't deserve it. You know who needs compassion? Someone in need. You know who needs dignity? Someone who's been stripped away of it. You know who needs truth? Someone who doesn't understand that they're walking in something that's not truth. Yet this is the way that Jesus loved, and we say, well, I'm going to remove love because you don't deserve it. Because, you know what, yeah, you might have a need for it, but that's what you get. Or, you know what, dignity, what is dignity nowadays? Who cares about dignity? That's not inherent. Or your truth, what is truth? It's whatever you want your truth to be. But Jesus said, this is the way that we love, and this is the way that we're supposed to live as followers of Jesus, people that adhere to this new that he's offering. But there's a second part to this, a second kind of caveat, if you will, and it was this. He spoke and he said, your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. Jesus said, I find this interesting, our love is what proves that we are his disciples. Not our church attendance, not our giving numbers, not whether or not you serve in your church or in your community, not how many volunteer hours you've logged in or put in, not how much you read your Bible, not if you ever read a Bible, but your love for one another. This is what proves you're my followers. You know what a proof is? A proof is something that validates the authenticity of another thing. And so your love is the proof. It validates the authenticity of who Jesus is and what Jesus said. And Jesus spoke, this is how everyone will know. And you know why they will know this? Because God is love. God is love, and so the world knows, look, I may not know about this Jesus, I may not understand the ins and outs of this thing, I don't know how we got here, but what I do know is that if I see love, then I can see God. And you know what's interesting about that is that the world is actually looking for love. Not like in a vague way, more specifically, they're looking to see if those of us who say we follow Jesus are actually going to show love.
Yeah.
That's what they want to know. And I could go on a soapbox about this, but whenever the media brings someone on, it's always this kind of like crazy Christian person out there, and it's like they're so devoid of love. I'm like, guys, this is a softball. Just show love. Instead, it's like judgment and hate, and of course, that's why they're there, because it gets ratings and da-da-da, and there's money tied to that and advertising and blah, 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 blah. But pick me if you're out there. Pick me, because I want to show love to people. I want them to see that Jesus loves all people and that Jesus loved me unconditionally, that I didn't have to be perfect because I'm far from it, but he came with that. Now, I've got a caveat here. I've got kind of a caution that I'll offer because, look, for as much as we know that God is love, what we get confused with in this world is that love is not God. You see, God is love. He's supreme. But love is not equal to God. Love itself is not God. Jesus didn't say love at every expense or love as the ultimate. He said love as I have loved you. Because the object of worship is not love itself, it's God. the supreme being, the one through whom love flows. And instead, what we do is we kind of switch these things and we start falling in love with, oh, just love, or oh, just this, or oh, like whatever this is. But the fact is, those things should actually point us back to God. And when we look to that, when we look to God, what we find are all the things that we listed before, with truth and compassion and dignity and grace. But if we miss the mark by idolizing or kind of placing the object of our worship on love itself and not on God, then we've missed the whole point of what Jesus said we're supposed to do. And the way, or the way that we're supposed to live, because Jesus offered us a new way of living in this. This is why we're here. You say, well, Ricky, this gets messy, or Ricky, this gets complicated. And the answer is, yeah, you're right. It's tricky. You see, Jesus simplified the way we ought to live by saying, here's the new commandment. Here's the new ethic. Here's the new way to live. Here's the new kind of governing principle. Love as I have loved you, and this type of love will prove to the world that you're my disciples. This is kind of the new governing principle. But if you're struggling with it, if you're like, well, how do I know what to do? Here's a simple question. You've heard me say it before. You've heard me offer it before. But it's this. Ask yourself this question. What does love require of me? Any situation, any person, any conversation, any dilemma, any challenge. Ask yourself the question, what does love require of me? I would love to say I'm the brainchild behind this, but I'm not that smart. But several years ago, maybe four years ago, this question was posed by another pastor in a sermon I heard. And I don't like to say that for 4 years I've been living by this. But in the instances that I've tried, in the instances that I've sought to live by this principle as kind of the governing ethic for how my life as a follower of Jesus would be on display to the world around me, you know what I found? Is that nearly 99 out of 100 times, I already know the answer. I already know the answer. When it comes to what does love require of me, I already know. I just don't want to show it. I just don't want to offer it because of my pride or my ego or my selfishness or my hurts or my fears or my worries or my anxieties or the feelings of like, well, what if this backfires? Or what is so-and-so over here going to say about me? What judgments are they going to make over how I engage in this situation or how I respond to this person? But when I come back to, I'm doing my best to live in the new that Jesus has for me, and he's offered me a new way to live, and that new way to live asks this question, and when I surrender to that, it frees up my world because I can love freely. I can love in an empowering way, not just to the person of receiving my love, but to me. Because what I realize is this is exactly what God has done for me. When God asked the question, what does love require of me? He said, it cost me my son. When God asked the question, what does love require of me? He said, it requires that I send my son. And that if my son goes, he's not just going to live, but he's got to die for them. And so I will send my son. Because that's what love requires in this moment. And so the question for you and I is, what does love require of me? But the follow-up to that is simply this. When you know, will you do it? When you know, will you do it? You see, Jesus left his disciples here 2,000 years ago because he needed something from them. What he needed from them was to show the world who he was. And as we'll talk about next week, this love, this governing principle, for the first 2, 3, 4, 5 centuries even, transformed the entire world we live in. You want to know how Christianity started in this small little region of a small little country that's no bigger than the state of New Jersey, and then has spread to the entire world? It was through love. And next week, we'll take a deeper look at that.
Hey, thanks for listening to this week's podcast. We hope it encourages you in your faith and blesses you throughout the week. If you'd like to find out more about Meta Church, you can find us online at meta.church, and we hope to see you again next week on the podcast.